to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Welcome to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Well, it has been a very busy week for news, my friends, and we have a lot to cover. So let's get started. The biggest news at home, I suppose, are the goings-on in Washington. The Democrats are doing their level best to impeach our president and get him the heck out of the White House. If not right away, well, at least by costing him the election of 2020. But I think they're heading for a fall. They're failing at their main objectives because the witnesses that they have been bringing to testify against him have been so lame and so unconvincing that they're digging the Democrats into a hole that they will not be able to get out of. In addition to contradicting each other, all the so-called evidence that they are, quote, revealing, is almost entirely hearsay. And hearsay is not evidence, it's hearsay. It's repeating something that has been said to them, told to them, reported to them by someone else. It's secondhand information. And that's why the so-called whistleblower isn't a whistleblower. Because everything he has said, he got from somewhere else. He didn't hear the president's conversation with Ukrainian President Zelensky. He heard about it from someone else who may actually have heard it. In which case, that person wasn't a whistleblower either because he or she didn't report it. He whispered it to someone else, who whispered it to Adam Schiff and members of his committee. Now, we would call the original person a leaker, or to be more precise, we would call him a spy who relayed privileged information to an unauthorized third person. Either way, if the identity of that person is discovered, there is likely to be trouble in his future, and maybe a lot of it. Now, Adam Schiff is, of course, as you know, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. And for some reason, that committee, the House Intelligence Committee, is carrying on the impeachment investigation instead of the House Judiciary Committee, which has done it in the past. Now, several weeks ago, it was reported that the so-called whistleblower had spoken to both Schiff and members of his committee, and Schiff did not deny this. But during testimony on Friday, Schiff insisted that he didn't know the name or the identity of the whistleblower. And furthermore, he warned everybody on the committee, particularly the Republicans, that if anyone were to leak the identity of the whistleblower, oh, there would be plenty of trouble. Of course, he failed to explain how he would know that the identity of the true whistleblower had been revealed if he doesn't know who it is. Well, what is most telling about the whistleblower is that his information is secondhand, as I said. And in his complaint, he wrote, quote, "I was not a direct witness to most of the events described," unquote. Which means exactly nothing. Because, again, it's hearsay. It's anything that he says, that he claims, that he is revealing, he has no firsthand knowledge of. And it's not even he said, it's he said that someone else said, and that has no basis in either reality or fact. It's just hearsay. Now, the extreme secrecy about the whistleblower, it borders on the bizarre. Because at least 2 weeks ago, the name of Eric Ciaramella came out. He was a protege of Susan Rice at the National Security Council, the NSC, and was also a former CIA agent. He was active in the development of the Russia-Russia conspiracy theories. And he is a Democrat, and he was Obama's director of Ukraine at the NSC. Is it coming together for you? Eric Ciaramella was outed as the whistleblower. Well, is he actually the whistleblower? My intelligence sources say that he is. And a new development in an interview that took place in secret after the public testimony on Friday. Although the secret testimony has not yet been released, and therefore no one who was there can talk about it, Congressman Lee Zeldin, who is a Republican from New York, has said that the testimony contained new information that was so revealing that it may well change the course of the investigation. So getting back to the impeachment exercise now going on in the Capitol, the United States Constitution states that a sitting president can be impeached for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, it's not specific about what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors, but it gives you a starting point anyway. When President Andrew Johnson was impeached, the House voted on 11 articles of impeachment, mostly over his alleged violation of the Tenure of Office Act. And when President Bill Clinton was impeached, he was charged with 4 articles of impeachment, and they were obstruction of justice, abuse of power, lying under oath to a grand jury, and lying under oath in a civil court case. In President Trump's case, the Democrats seem to be circling around several so-called crimes that the president is supposed to have committed, according to them. Last Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi accused the president of 4 impeachable crimes. Let's take a quick look at what they are. First of all, she accused him of bribery when he allegedly tried to pressure the Ukrainian president into investigating his political rivals. And in exchange for that, according to Pelosi, the United States would provide securities assistance and a White House meeting. Now, there was a military security aid package that Trump held up for 55 days. He did hold it up. And Pelosi called this a bribe. But what the president was actually doing was what is generally done. In fact, he would have been remiss had he not done it. It's called due diligence. He was making sure that the money would be going for its intended purpose and not into the pockets of corrupt politicians and industrialists, something that has described Ukraine for a very long time. This is standard operating procedure, and 55 days is a very short period in which to carry out such a complicated due diligence. And by the way, in 2012, do you remember when President Obama promised the Russian president flexibility after the next election? Well, within a couple of years, Russia invaded the Crimean Peninsula and took it away from Ukraine. And then they positioned more than 40,000 troops on Ukraine's border and sent thousands of Russian soldiers into the country. What did Obama do to help the Ukrainians? Nothing. In spite of their extraordinarily dangerous situation and their desperate request for defensive weapons, arms, and ammunition, and intelligence support against the Russian military, Obama did not send any of the defensive weapons and support they requested. He did send, however, military rations called MREs, meals ready to eat. You can imagine what they taste like. Some night vision goggles and blankets. Lots of blankets. Ukraine asked for arms and ammunition and intelligence, and they got blankets. Obama refused to provide any of the military, the lethal aid, such as anti-tank weapons, that Ukraine desperately needed to fight off the Russian invasion. It was awful. Now, Trump, on the other hand, who apparently recognized the real threat that Russia still poses in that part of the world, provided the Ukraine with anti-tank missiles, including the powerful Javelin system. Defense News reported that Ukraine's military attaché in Washington said, quote, When Ukraine's military began using American Javelin anti-tank weapons, Russian tanks and armored personnel carriers that once operated with devastating impunity had backed off. Unquote. And that, my friends, was the point. Okay, so here's another thing. The target of Trump's request to Zelensky was not Trump's political opponent. Joe Biden is not running against Trump, not yet, at least. He's running against a bunch of other Democrats, lots of them. And the field is still growing, my gosh. So Biden is a candidate, one among many. But what else he is a former vice president, who, it appears, engaged in exactly the same crime that Pelosi and her cronies are accusing Trump of. And Biden threatened to withhold promised funds if the Ukraine government would not fire a certain prosecutor for the benefit of his son, Hunter Biden. He threatened to hold back $1 billion in loan guarantees. So how did we learn about this? It wasn't hearsay. Biden bragged about it in a speech that was recorded for posterity by the press. So my point is that what Trump was interested in finding out was about the possible corruption carried out by a former U.S. vice president in Ukraine. I've said this before. Just because a person is running for public office, even the presidency, that doesn't make him immune from criticism and even prosecution from crimes, and even prosecution for crimes he committed before he ran for office. Okay, now another thing that Pelosi accused President Trump of was conspiracy. She said he conspired with his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, Attorney General William Barr, and others to illegally pressure the Ukrainian government to do political favors for him. Well, you know, that's more of the same. There is no proof, so far, of any crimes or conspiracy. All the testimony has been based on hearsay. And that's just not good enough. And another thing that Pelosi accused him of was witness intimidation, illegally, mind you, illegally, intimidating Marie Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, by attacking her on Twitter while she testified before Congress. Did you read that tweet? There was nothing illegal about it. Only a twit would have been intimidated by that tweet. If Adam Schiff hadn't made a point of reading the tweet out loud into the record, Yovanovitch would never have known about it and certainly wouldn't have been intimidated by it. And by the way, she wasn't testifying in a court of law where witness intimidation might be applicable as a legal issue in the first place. You know, in the hearing on Friday, the Democrats talked a lot about how brave she was throughout her career, representing our country in places like Somalia and Ukraine. And no doubt she was. Those were scary places to be during times of war. But if she was brave in face of brutal wars, surely allowing herself to be characterized as intimidated by a derogatory tweet should have been deeply insulting to her. And utterly ridiculous. Now, there's another aspect of these hearings that intrigues me. Adam Schiff. He is a bold-faced liar, and he lies about everything, even it seems when he doesn't have to. He clearly lied about the whistleblower, and he lied repeatedly when he claimed to have incontrovertible evidence of Donald Trump's crimes way back during the Mueller investigation and long after it was over. But he never produced a shred of evidence. It was all talk, and it was all lies. He also tries to hide the truth by only allowing the Democrats on his committee the full freedom to interview the witnesses. In an appalling show of disrespect and rudeness on Friday, he repeatedly cut off the efforts of a rising star in the Republican ranks, Representative Elise Stefanik from upstate New York. She was dauntless as she tried to make herself heard, and as Schiff continually tried to shut her up, she continued to raise her voice above his, and in the end, he succeeded in shutting her down, but also called attention to this awesome woman who stood up to him and called him out for his unfairness and his despotic behavior. I suspect that we will hear a lot more from Congresswoman Stefanik, and I, for one, am looking forward to it. Adam Schiff's production that he calls an impeachment investigation is truly a circus act. He is trying to create an illusion of respectability when it is nothing more than fraud. Fraud designed to bring down a duly elected president by trying to paint him with a brush of criminal activity that doesn't apply to him. And Adam Schiff is failing and looking more and more desperate. Every day that the hearings continue, he looks more like a fool. And the president gains more and more support as a result. Through their own desperation to beat the president and maintain their own political power, Adam Schiff and Nancy Pelosi will be the downfall of their own Democrat Party. The 2020 elections are not that far off anymore. And when they come around, whatever the polls may say now, whatever the mainstream media may be promoting on behalf of their favorite candidates, I think America is going to be in for an awakening as the large, silent, but powerful majority of this country goes to the polls and votes to re-elect our president, Donald J. Trump, for another 4 years. I could be wrong, but I don't think I will be. So now it's time for a short break, but when I come back, we'll talk about the astonishing revolutions that are going on in Iraq, Iran, and Syria. It's not what you're thinking. We're not going to talk about the Kurds, and we're not going to talk about Turkey. We're going to talk about those three countries, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And you would be surprised, you may be astonished, I was, to know that what is going on is something huge that very few people expected. I'll give you a hint. Iran is losing. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
As we say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
So now, let's take a look at the rest of the world. It has always been torn by war and strife and suffering. And for as long as people have been living here. Always, in other words. But in the last century, Hong Kong was really an exception. An island of relative peace in a sea of hostility and war. Until now. Because what's going on in Hong Kong today is a terrible tragedy for a people and for a city. We've talked about this since the unrest began. Until the demonstrations turned ugly, that city, Hong Kong, was unique in the world. It was unique in that, although it's part of China, which is ruled under a harsh communist government, Hong Kong has been functioning as a free market economy. And its people have enjoyed a relatively autonomous existence within a free market economy that simply doesn't exist on the mainland of China. For the last century or so, Hong Kong has functioned under what they call one country, two systems policy. And until recently, it worked relatively well. But when the China-appointed authorities in Hong Kong tried to pass a very unpopular extradition law, the people of Hong Kong rebelled, and the demonstrations began. Now, in the beginning, they were extraordinary, because even though the number of people in some of the demonstrations surpassed 1 million Hong Kongers on the streets of the city, the demonstrations were almost entirely peaceful. But as the sides became more entrenched in their positions, the people of Hong Kong and the police, the violence began to creep into the weekly demonstrations. And this past weekend, demonstrators, for example, were besieged in the Polytechnic University after more than 2 days of confrontations with the police. And when they tried to leave, they were beaten back by police with water cannons and firing rubber bullets and tear gas. At least 235 people were injured and taken to the hospital. In all, some 1,100 people were arrested within a 24-hour period. And more than 5,000 people have been arrested since the demonstrations began in June. Now, President Xi Jinping has promised to keep the one country, two systems formula, but he has accused foreign countries of inciting the rioting. And the demonstrations go on, and the violence continues to rise. Since the island of Hong Kong was ceded to the British in 1842 after the First Opium War, it gradually became the financial capital of Asia, with a stock exchange that is Asia's third largest after the Tokyo Stock Exchange and the Shanghai Stock Exchange, and Hong Kong is the fourth single largest stock market in the world. Before the demonstrations began nearly 6 months ago, it was reported to be the fastest growing stock exchange in Asia. But in the wake of the current demonstrations and the growing violence, the future of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange is in doubt. Now, investors can, of course, turn to other places like Singapore, Tokyo, and Shanghai to access global capital markets. But it's the Hong Kong stock market that has the greatest leverage because it is not on the mainland like Shanghai, and has been able in the past, because of the one country, two systems policy, to give investors greater economic and legal freedoms and security not found in mainland China. Now, the violence and chaos that have erupted as a result of the unwillingness of China to honor its agreement to ensure autonomy to the territory have now crippled the city, disrupted the daily conduct of business, hurt the commerce on the island, and damaged investor sentiment. And while Hong Kong is mired in political chaos, and a devastating crisis may be on the horizon, the city's stock market, which has been struggling with the social unrest for nearly half a year, seems to be hanging on and keeping afloat. So far, the monetary crisis that was forecast as a result of the unrest hasn't happened, and that's a good thing. Now, we still have a lot to see about what's going to happen next in Hong Kong. As the demonstrators become more chaotic, the situation could get very ugly very quickly. So we have to wait and see on this. But so far, there has been a limit to the number of casualties and to the overall impact on Hong Kong's future. We'll have to see. But I will keep you abreast of what's going on. I will continue to do that. And now, I told you before that there is a revolution going on in the Middle East, and it involves Iran. Iran is not a new enemy for us. We go back a long way, and we have never been friends. Not since the Ayatollah Khomeini assumed power in Iran after the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and the student occupation of the American embassy for nearly a year. And what's going on now in the Middle East against Iran is noteworthy. So here is the story. The Middle East is currently witnessing popular rebellions in several countries that are dominated by Iran. In recent years, Iran has slowly but surely been infiltrating Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. Each country has a different story, and in each country, the civil unrest is growing. In all of these countries, the growing unrest is blamed on the political and economic corruption and the growing frustrations of the people when they can't access the basic resources of life. The demonstrators are facing the domination of their country by a government that is managed by a foreign government, Iran. In the final analysis, the cause of the national unrest in each country has a single cause. Iran's intrusion into the internal affairs of the countries that it wants to control, and their sole focus on its political and military agenda, regardless of the impact on the population, which in all cases has been negative. Iran's presence in these countries has therefore led to a significant growth in popular unrest. And it's all happening as we speak. It's all started to happen recently and spontaneously, it seems, and in all countries. Let's start with Lebanon. Iran has had a presence in Lebanon since at least 1983, when its proxy, the developing organization later known as Hezbollah, used huge truck bombs to blow up the American embassy in Beirut and the U.S. Marines barracks at the Beirut airport. The two attacks killed 368 people and wounded 248 more. As Iran's hold on Lebanon became stronger, though, through its efforts to build up the power of Hezbollah, it built its own power in the region through both military and political action. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach to gaining power in Lebanon, through Hezbollah and on its own. In Lebanon, protests are sweeping the country as we speak. And although the government led by Hezbollah is known to be very repressive, some of the protesters have even spoken out against Hezbollah, which is, as you know, a terrorist organization, and it is strongly backed by Iran. Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah has promised to, quote, prevent the fall of the besieged Hezbollah government, unquote. But at least one Lebanese politician has said publicly that it's time to stop Iranian intervention in Lebanon. Now, this is a new development. This is not something that anyone would have dreamed of doing maybe only a year ago. Things are changing in the Middle East. The Lebanese people began protesting new taxes on tobacco, gasoline, and internet phone services. But their protests have turned into a broader challenge to the deeply entrenched corruption in the political world of their government. And although the demonstrators are not directing their grievances against either Hezbollah or Iran, they want the current coalition of corrupt politicians gone. They want them replaced. The people are angry. They're protesting Lebanon's deteriorating economic state, its massive unemployment, and a national debt that is soaring out of control. Now, you'll notice that as we go through these countries, you'll see that the same thing is happening over and over again. This is the effect that Iran is having on the states that it tries to control. And then there's Syria. Iran's major intrusion there began in 2011 when it took advantage of the opportunity that was presented by the beginning of a so-called civil war. Thousands of IRGC fighters were sent into Syria to protect Syria's president, Bashar Assad, and they were joined by 5,000 Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon. And they never left. Quite the opposite. In the years that followed, they strengthened their presence. Iran also sent tens of thousands of regular army and IRGC soldiers and officers, including combat troops, into Syria. And thousands of these soldiers, both the army, the IRGC soldiers and officers, and the Hezbollah fighters, have died in the Syrian conflict. I'll make an educated guess and suggest that Iran has spent as much as $15 billion in its efforts to prop up Syria's President Bashar Assad, even though the Iranian economy has been failing because of the sanction that we, the U.S., put on the country. In the latest conflict, Iranian soldiers in Syria are being attacked by snipers, and the morale among the Iranian officers is flagging. So, and then we have Iraq. Iran now controls the government in Iraq, as well as in Lebanon and in Syria. But here, too, the nature of the protests has morphed into something more than what it began with. The protests began in Iraq on October 1st in Baghdad, and it started out because of the firing of a popular general. But the demonstrations began to expand almost immediately to include economic and social issues, including the lack of affordable housing for young people, and the basic issue of unelected Iranian power that has taken over the Iraqi government. These demonstrations spread quickly to a number of cities in southern Iraq. Their most recent focus is the Green Zone in Baghdad. U.S. News reported that a young man told them, quote, "I want change. I want to remove these corrupt people who sleep in the Green Zone and who fired tear gas and rubber bullets at us," unquote. And that is exactly what is likely to stir the unrest even more, this show of force, as the demonstrators are being fired on and some of them are being killed by the Iranian and the Iraqi soldiers. Since the demonstrations began, hundreds of unarmed demonstrators have been shot dead, and many are wounded as well. The demonstrations that are going on in Iraq right now are fierce and they're violent, and according to intelligence sources, things are not going well for Iran. So they're being harassed in Lebanon, they're being shot at in Syria, and they're being attacked by mobs in Iraq. In the very different context of Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, the protests now underway have a similar focus on political and economic corruption, mismanagement, and limited popular access to basic resources. And in all these cases, the demonstrators are being confronted with the fact that their countries are dominated by a foreign power that just couldn't care less about their well-being and are making life extremely difficult for the people who live there. So finally we get to Iran, which is where this entire scenario begins and ends. Whatever Iran is doing in other countries, it is doing at home as well. As the result of the sanctions that the U.S. has placed on Iranian oil exports, Iran's economy is failing, and the Iranian people are suffering. There's a shortage of just about everything, and the prices of even the most basic necessities are often out of reach for the average Iranian. So they are demonstrating against the high prices, against inflation, and against the poverty that the mullahs have inflicted upon the Iranian people. The anti-regime protests began on Friday, November 15th, after the government tripled the price of gasoline. And unbelievably, the people are chanting, "Death to the dictator," in spite of a major crackdown by the authorities. Imagine, this is Iran. Do you remember the last time there was such a popular uprising and we saw the murders in the street by the Iranian police? Yet the people in Iran have found the courage to go back to the streets and demonstrate against the government. That, my friends, is real courage. Resistance units of the main Iranian opposition force, known as the MEK, are helping to coordinate many of the protests. And they're also distributing videos of the demonstrations to raise international support for them. In one video, a brave Iranian woman chants, quote, "Threats and prisons no longer affect us," unquote. And in an intercepted radio communication in which head of the Greater Tehran Police is heard saying, as protesters take over, he says, "They're destroying everything. There's 5,000 of them," unquote. And this was distributed on Twitter by the MEK network. The voice of the Iranian people is finally being heard. In another tweet, Shiraz, which is in south-central Iran, is falling into the hands of protesters. Members of the regime's parliament are acknowledging that the situation is now a crisis. And if you want to follow this yourself, go to Twitter and type in the search box, hashtag Iran protests. And in response to the demonstrations, Iran has shut down telecommunications, including cell phone and internet. But the battle for a voice does not end at Iran's borders. The most encouraging thing I saw on Twitter was from our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who wrote, "I have a message for the people of Iran. The United States hears you. The United States supports you. The United States is with you. And I hope that's right. I do remember when the Green Revolution took place in 2012 in Iran, and the revolution was dramatically and violently put down on the streets of Iran, and we watched as civilians were killed, were shot dead in the street. We waited for President Obama to say something, to do something, but he did nothing. It is up to us to be the light unto the nations. It is up to us to stand with those who suffer under tyranny. We cannot save the world, but there is an old expression that goes, he who has saved one life, it's as if he has saved the whole world. We cannot save the whole world, but we can help to save a part of it. Now, I'm going to take another short break, but don't go away because I will be back with another installment of my favorite part of this show. You just can't make this stuff up.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Well, here we are, and it's time for You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up. Well, most of you have heard by now about Burger King's Impossible Whopper. They introduced it to the world this past summer with a huge amount of television advertising and so forth. Their website says that the sandwich features, quote, a savory flame-grilled patty made from plants, topped with juicy tomatoes, fresh lettuce, creamy mayonnaise, ketchup, crunchy pickles, and sliced white onions on a soft sesame bun. 100% Whopper, 0% beef. And then down below in tiny little print, it also says, quote, for guests looking for a meat-free option, a non-broiler method of preparation is available upon request, unquote. In the TV commercial, they say it tastes like a real burger. And they say that it's vegetarian and anyone can eat it and enjoy it. Well, someone didn't really enjoy it at all, and they're suing Burger King. And here's why. Burger King acknowledges that the Impossible Whopper is flame-grilled on the same broiler as its chicken and beef products. Uh-oh. What this means is that the so-called meatless burger actually comes into contact with whatever was on the grill before it got there. And the bits of meat and poultry that were on the grill contaminate the all-vegetarian burger that isn't. And if you're a customer who takes your vegetarian food seriously, you're going to be very unhappy with this. If you're a vegan, it's much worse because the Impossible Whopper comes with mayonnaise, which is made with eggs, and a poppy seed bun, which I'm pretty sure is made with milk. That makes this meal more like an impossible flopper. You just can't make this stuff up. Okay, let's get back to the news. Last week, I promised you a full analysis of the open hearings in the so-called impeachment investigation. I've already told you about some of the aspects of the process, but now I want to get into some of the weeds. The weeds as they apply to the perspective of the witnesses and the congresspeople who interviewed them. On Tuesday, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was a fascinating witness because his point of view was deeply colored by his military background, and he brought a new perspective to the whole issue of the famous phone call between U.S. President Trump and Ukraine President Zelensky. It gave an excellent illustration of how people can both misinterpret and be misinterpreted by one's own perspective. One of the central themes of the investigation as it regarded the phone call was whether President Trump had put pressure on President Zelensky to carry out an investigation of the business dealings of Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, while he was on the board of a company called Burisma Holdings, a Ukrainian gas company. You know, the question is about why Biden the Younger got hired by the Ukrainian gas company, since he had no background or expertise in the industry. I mentioned this earlier. The unspoken question here is like the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Was Hunter hired because he gave the Ukrainians access to the Vice President of the United States? I haven't actually heard anyone ask it. But never mind, let me make my point. Colonel Vindman brought a unique point of view to the subject of the phone call, and he was one of the many people who were on the line and heard the conversation. Here's what the president actually said on that phone call. Quote, "I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot, and Ukraine knows a lot about it." And then he went on to talk about another issue. But he came back to this favor. He said, "There's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me." Unquote. When Trump asked Zelensky for a favor, the question was this: was he putting pressure on the Ukrainian president? If you had asked me, I would say no. Trump was asking him to do a favor for him. Simple. Now, if I had been a Russian, I might have been insulted. Did you know that in Russia, asking someone to do you a favor is an insult? I once had a Russian friend who was very offended when I used that phrase in reference to something I had done for him, as in, "I'm doing you a favor." He was so insulted that he didn't talk to me for a year. I don't know if the same nuance exists in Ukraine, but clearly Zelensky wasn't offended, and he said that he didn't feel pressured. But Colonel Vindman is a military man, and the way he looked at that conversation was unlike anything I would even have thought of. For Colonel Vindman, it wasn't about words. It was about his perception of the relationship between President Trump and President Vindman. And that perception that he had colored the way he understood the conversation between them. But here it is. Vindman perceived a power imbalance between Trump and Zelensky. In this conversation, in Vindman's view, Trump was the superior, and Zelensky was the subordinate. As Vindman himself said at the hearing, quote, "When a superior makes a request, that's an order," unquote. He might say it politely, but it would be meant to be carried out. So when Trump asked Zelensky to, quote, do him a favor, unquote, it was not, in Vindman's mind, a request. It was an order. And that colored his analysis of the call, which colored his testimony. Because he saw Trump clearly putting pressure on Zelensky, from superior to subordinate. In the eyes of both presidents, however, I don't think that power balance existed, which is why both said that there was no pressure at all. And this brings me to a larger picture. When we're dealing with international relations with people from different cultures, and quite possibly speaking different languages, there's a great deal of room for misunderstanding. It reminds me of a story of a French ambassador who came to the U.S. to ask Congress for some funding. He spoke before Congress in his native language, French, and he began his appeal by saying, "Je demande," which means, "I'm asking." But the translator took it literally and translated it as, "I demand." The way I heard this story, he did not get the funding. International relations are fraught with all kinds of pitfalls based on misunderstandings of all kinds. A friend of mine, who was a well-known conductor, once had the opportunity to conduct the opera Carmen in Paris. Now, he was Italian, and he was thrilled to be conducting in Paris. But here we're dealing with what they call cross-cultural communications. Expressions or hand gestures or body language of some kind may mean something in one culture and may mean something entirely different in another. My friend found this out the hard way. The orchestra was excellent and performed the overture perfectly. Before the curtain went up, my friend made the OK sign by curling the thumb and index finger into a circle to let them know they had done a great job. If he'd been in New York or in Los Angeles, it would have been fine. But in France, that hand sign means something extremely rude, which I can't say on the air. And so from that moment on, the orchestra did what they pleased and didn't pay any further attention to their conductor. The only satisfaction that he got from that performance was that he could tell that story many times over afterwards and get a laugh, which is exactly how I heard it. It's all about communication. And if you can't understand each other, if you're talking different languages, if your body language is out of sync, the end result will be misunderstanding and then, most likely, failure. Another interesting facet of this investigation is the so-called whistleblower. I talked about him before, and I said that he really wasn't a whistleblower, just a leaker, because he didn't have any first-hand knowledge. And I also talked about how we think he has already been outed several weeks ago. The people who outed him gave his name, and I told you that before as well. But the question that came up on Tuesday was whether or not Adam Schiff's effort to shield him from discovery were legal. Did he, in fact, have any legal protection from being identified and brought in as a witness to be questioned? We know that there are laws protecting whistleblowers. But first of all, there must be a definition of a whistleblower. And an individual with secondhand knowledge may not fit that category. The second question is, does the legal protection of a whistleblower protect him from discovery, which is to say, protects him from revealing who he is, or does it just protect him from prosecution and from losing his job? Those are the questions that I would ask, and I think those are the questions that were asked on Tuesday. Schiff was asked directly to show that there was some legal justification to protect him from discovery. Schiff didn't respond, of course, so we have yet to find out what the answer to that question is. And will we ever find out, or will Adam Schiff continue to lie about whether or not he knows his identity? He has said both yes and no. Altogether, Schiff has been playing fast and loose with the rules that apply to impeachment investigations. And it has become all too clear that he really wants the rules to obey him, rather than the other way around. So now, getting back to the actual so-called impeachment investigation, I've been watching it as much as possible, and I'm increasingly glad that when I ran for Congress, I lost. In the course of my campaign, someone asked me, "Why do you want to be part of that cesspool?" Well, in the face of what we are witnessing today, he was absolutely right, and I'm glad I'm not there. The so-called investigation is a farce. Getting Donald Trump has been the all-consuming passion of the Democrat Party since before the 2016 election. And you know what? It's sad. It's more than sad. It's pathetic. The Democrats are so filled with hate and the need to retaliate for losing the election to Donald Trump that it is all they can think about. The trade agreement with Mexico and Canada? Nah, not important. The bill is sitting on Nancy Pelosi's desk, ready for a vote, but she won't bring it to the floor. I think she must be using it for some kind of leverage, but the bill that would bring benefits to our farmers and manufacturers is languishing on her desk. It's shameful. The impeachment investigation is the only thing that's important to them, and everything else falls by the wayside. The impeachment investigation, like the Mueller investigation before it, is a scavenger hunt in search of a crime. The Mueller report spent, 2 years doing their investigation, going down all kinds of rabbit holes, and they found nothing. There was no crime. There was no collusion. The Democrats keep looking for a crime, and in nearly 3 years, they haven't found one. And it wasn't for want of looking. And the amount of money they are spending on the search is appalling. The Mueller investigation alone cost more than $30 million. And who knows what this investigation will cost. The good news is that we have an election coming up soon. The Iowa caucus will kick it off on February 3rd, 2020. And then we're off and running. The polls won't tell us much. They're largely inaccurate. We have only to look back at the polls in 2016 that assured us that Hillary would win in a landslide. But the real question, anyway, is whether all the hysteria about Russia, Russia, collusion, collusion, quid pro quo, extortion, and now bribery will all be too much for an American people yearning for some peace and quiet from the political hysteria. It's altogether possible that many of them will say, "Enough!" and cast their vote for the man who actually did something for them, created their jobs, gave them a small raise in pay by lowering their taxes. I'm with them. Maybe these are the people who will come out to vote in droves and send Donald Trump back to the White House for another 4 years. And just because the Democrats forgot what their jobs were, and forgot whom they were supposed to be representing, the American people. Well, we're just about out of time, but there is one more story I'd just like to spend a couple of minutes on. On Tuesday night, IDF, Israeli Defense Force fighter jets, attacked dozens of military targets belonging to the Iranian Quds Force, which is the elite unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC. In response to rockets that had been fired by an Iranian force from Syrian territory at Israel, IDF fighters struck dozens of military targets, including surface-to-air missiles, headquarters, weapons warehouses, and even military bases. And this all happened overnight on Tuesday. During the IDF strike, a Syrian air defense missile was fired, despite clear warnings that the Syrians and the Iranians should refrain from such fire. As a result, a number of Syrian aerial defense batteries were also destroyed. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said about the airstrikes in Syria, quote, "I made it clear that whoever harms us, we will harm him. This is what we did tonight against military targets of the Iranian Quds Force and Syrian military targets in Syria. We will continue to maintain Israel's security." And Defense Minister Naftali Bennett also commented, saying, quote, "Our message to the Iranian leaders is simple. You are no longer immune. Wherever you send your octopus arms, we will cut them off," unquote. We'll have more about this next week because this is an ongoing story. Well, we're out of time. It's been great being with you. It always is. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope we'll see you again next week. You've been listening to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this has been the Friedman Report.